بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. Today we are going to talk about the rest of the history of philosophy in the West. But before that, I thought it might be at least necessary to talk about the influences that Muslim philosophers had on Greek philosophy. Of course, again, this needs lots of discussions, and thanks to God, investigations have been made by great scholars to show which changes have been made by Muslim philosophers and to prove that Islamic philosophy is not just another version of Greek philosophy. But we don't have that much time for this purpose. So very quickly, just in a few minutes, I'm going to refer to one of the important statements and remarks made by Ayatollah Shahid Mutahhari in his lecture on the history of Islamic philosophy, which is published separately as a paper. He says that if we want to classify philosophical problems which are discussed and studied by Muslim philosophers, we can classify them into four categories. Firstly, we can refer to a group of philosophical problems which have not changed after entrance into Islamic world. For example, if Aristotle was talking about the cause and effect and the necessity of every effect to be preceded by four forms of causes, this is also discussed by Muslim philosophers. So this issue itself is preserved. This is one category. So the role of Muslim philosophers here was to translate, and because they felt it appropriate, they felt that these are backed up by arguments, they accepted that. And this is good, because whenever you see something good in hands of others, you should not reject it, you should accept it. And this is what we have in Hadith. الحكمة الضالة المؤمن أينما وجدها أخذها. Wisdom is what Muslim is looking for, is something that you have lost. Of course, wisdom here doesn't mean philosophy, it has a very broad sense. أينما وجدها أخذها. A believer in God, wherever finds wisdom, a piece of wisdom or a wise saying, a wise statement, a wise idea, takes it and accepts it. So Muslims accepted some of the philosophical problems of Greek philosophy and kept it as it was. The second category is that there were some philosophical problems that was supported by some arguments among Greek philosophers. And Muslim philosophers found that the idea is correct, but arguments need to be improved. So they may not be happy with the argument, may not have been happy with the arguments put forward by the Greek philosophers, or they may have added some arguments. For example, if they had very limited number of arguments for the existence of God. Muslim philosophers have had more. And in philosophy, it's very important to have as many as possible arguments, as many as possible. Because many people, even when there is a proof, there is a sound argument, still, because of the complicatedness of the issue, may have not confidence in what you are arguing for. So it's better that to have more arguments, as many as possible. So sometimes Muslims preserve the idea, even they may have accepted some of the arguments, but they had complementary arguments and completed the job and task of the Greek philosophers. The third category or class is that sometimes there was a philosophical problem, philosophical issue in Greek philosophy, and Muslims kept the name, but the essence, the substance is totally changed. They have had totally new and novel idea. For example, the idea that Muslims had about the unity of existence is very original and is different from what used to be among Greeks or among Eastern thinkers, for example, in India. So this is also another category. So the name may look the same, but the content, the substance of the problem is different. And fourthly, we come to a category which is more important for us, and that regards issues, problems, which were totally new, raised by Muslim philosophers, discussed by Muslim philosophers for the first time. And these are very important. This shows the originality of Islamic philosophy. For example, I just refer to some of those problems that were first of all raised by Muslim philosophers. For example, the idea of fundamentality or primordiality of wujud, existence, asalatul wujud. This is something new. This was not there before Islamic philosophy. Or the idea of unity of existence, wahdatul wujud. The idea of mental existence, al-wujud al-zehni. The discussion about qualities of nothingness, ahkamul adam, qualities of nothingness. These were new. The discussion about the impossibility of reversing nothingness. So when something is not there, so it cannot be revived, it cannot be brought again into existence. If it is brought into existence, this is not the thing which used to be. Because some people have had wrong idea that the resurrection means to give existence to something which used to be existent. So you have had something like a human body, a human soul. This exists for a period, then it expires, ceases to exist, then it again comes to existence. This is not a right and correct idea about resurrection. We don't believe that by death we expire or we perish. Anyway, if something exists and then it ceases to exist, then you cannot have it again. That would be totally different. This is also an issue discussed by Muslim philosophers for the first time. Or a very important topic in philosophy and theology, and that is, what is the reason for need for a cause? Why does an effect need a cause? What makes an effect depend on a cause? Is it existence? Is it the fact that it is preceded by nothingness? Is it contingent being that makes it rely and depend on the cause? This was a very important issue, and Muslim philosophers studied this properly, and they proved that the reason for need for a cause is to be contingent. When a quiddity, a nature, al-mahiyya, is contingent, it needs to have a cause to necessitate the side of existence. And this need is always there as long as you have a mahiyya, a nature, a quiddity. Because to be contingent is part of the essence of mahiyya. If I'm saying part of the essence, I mean required, implied by the essence. It's one of the qualities of the essence of nature. So you cannot say that an effect needs in its beginning to be caused, but when it is caused, then there is no longer need for a cause. No. This need is always there. This need is part of the essential quality of a contingent being. This was also an issue which was very important in Islamic philosophy. Also, the idea of philosophical secondary intellectual concepts. This is a very important topic. Al-ma'qulat al-thaniya al-falsafiyya. We have different forms of concepts, and Muslim philosophers were able to distinguish between different forms of concept, al-ma'qulat al-ula and al-ma'qulat al-thaniya. Then between al-ma'qulat al-thaniya al-mantiqiyya, which are logical, and al-falsafiyya, which are the philosophical. This is very, very complicated and important issue, and this is the key to solve many philosophical issues. Or, for example, the idea of substantial movement, al-haraka al-jawhariyya. This was new. This was introduced by Sadruddin Shirazi, and many, many other issues. So I felt responsible to give you some clues so that you can later follow up this issue to see that how active and how novel were Muslim philosophical circles. Okay, now let's go to the rest of the discussion about the history of philosophy in the West. If you remember, we said that after Aristotle, his students and students of other great masters of philosophy continued the role and the task of great philosophers such as Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle in spreading the philosophical thought. Then there was a period in which philosophy moved to Alexandria. And then we said that there was a period in which Roman emperors who had embraced Christianity stopped philosophical discussions, lectures, closed up schools and universities in the West, because they felt that it is against their faith. Or they may just wanted to show to the Pope that they were loyal to the Church. So in the 6th century, a ban was put on philosophical movements and discussions. And this continued for about 1,000 years. And this period, this long period, is called Medieval Ages. This is the period in which the church had total control and total power in Europe. And whenever they felt that some philosophical idea or scientific idea does not fit in with their understanding of faith, with their understanding of the Bible, they were very strict in prosecuting that philosopher or that scientist. And you know many cases of that. You know that how Galileo was put on trial. And you know that some people were killed, many people were imprisoned, because just they had some ideas which were not in compliance with the ideas of the church. In this period, the attention of people, of scholars, of talented students towards philosophy was in decline, because many people felt that it's dangerous for them and they didn't dare to get involved in philosophical issues. Whenever there is such a thing in the spirit of the society or spirit of the age, so many people who have not that much determination, they just follow the current, the streamline in the society. So if the society is not in favor of philosophy, so many people reject philosophy or at least leave it aside, then don't take it seriously. Of course, there are people who are always determined and they dare to follow what they find it to be truthful, even if it's not encouraged by the society or by the authorities. In this period, in this medieval ages, which some people call it dark ages, there have been many good points, many good ideas. And I am not one of those people who always criticize medieval ages or West in the medieval ages 100%. Many people in the West criticize these ages 100% because this was also an age in which people had great attachment to God and to religion. And many people are not happy with this aspect of medieval ages. So when we are criticizing medieval ages, we are not criticizing it 100%. We are not criticizing this age thoroughly. We want to distinguish between good points and bad points, advantages and disadvantages. We feel that one of the disadvantages of this period was lack of freedom in society, especially lack of freedom of scholars and scientists. However, one has to bear in mind that there were some great fathers of church who tried to reconcile between philosophy and Christianity. For example, Saint Augustine, a very famous father of church, he try to bring these two together. Of course, he was not that much sympathetic with Aristotle, as I mentioned before in one of our previous discussions, but he was sympathetic with the ideas of Plato and also Neoplatonic ideas, and he thought that it's possible to combine Christianity and Platonic ideas together, but he was not that much in favor of philosophy as a whole. It was later, after familiarity of the West with works of Aristotle through Muslim philosophers, and after observing the way that Muslim philosophers were able to adapt Greek philosophy to their faith, and how they used Greek philosophy to support their faith, that they were encouraged to do the same. So Thomas Aquinas, after studying many works of Ibn Sina, whom he frequently mentions his works, he was successful to a great extent to present a form of Christian theology which reconciles Aristotelian way of thought with teachings of the church. And he was very influential. He was very great person in the history of church, a great father and a great doctor of church. And the Christian philosophy, to a large extent, is in debt to him. And especially the Roman Catholic Church is very much supportive of the ideas of Thomas Aquinas. So here you see that gradually philosophy is coming again into scene. Then later you see that there were some big changes in Europe that led to the change of the policy of church without consent or with consent. Sometimes the church was forced to withdraw from her traditional positions, and sometimes willingly the church knew. For example, teachings of Thomas Aquinas and the people who followed his path was very important to help the church to decide inside herself that there must be more attention paid towards philosophy and science, and this was some important internal change. But some also external factors happened and came into existence which changed the course of history at that time. For example, the author refers to seven important factors which caused medieval ages to come to an end. For example, in France and England, there was a tendency towards a special school of thought called nominalism. This was some idea which was against belief in any sort of substance. They felt that concepts are only names without having any content, without having any substance to refer at. When you say human, when you say, for example, tree, flower, and whatsoever, these are only just some names without any content, without any meaning. Of course, they had meanings in the literal sense, but I mean by meaning something in the reality that this name refers at. So this nominalism was something which was to some extent popular in France and England, and it caused the change of intellectual atmosphere in Europe. It caused some people starting seriously making doubts about the scholastic ideas of the church, the scholastic philosophy. When we say scholastic, means philosophies which were taught in the schools under the supervision of the church. The second important phenomenon at that time was that Aristotle's metaphysics was debated in universities in France, particularly in Paris. This was also a very important idea, because church had accepted wholeheartedly physics of Aristotle, natural sciences in the way that Aristotle had put forward. So after a big period of making doubts about Aristotle, when they embraced Aristotle, they even embraced physics of Aristotle, natural sciences. And some of them were against the findings of modern sciences. So in universities in Paris, scientists who were now able to have more observations and more experimental discussions and investigations, they showed that there are weaknesses in the ideas of Aristotle regarding physics. This was also a big shock. Thirdly, some people started to think that some ideas of the church are against reason. For example, they thought that Trinity is not compatible with reason. Of course, doctors of the church themselves had the idea that there are some issues, some doctrines, some dogmas of the church which cannot be understood by reason. But they were considering it as something ordinary, something not harmful. Whoever has strong faith must accept them. And it's quoted from Augustine, Saint Augustine, that he said, believe and then you come to know. So you first accept and then you understand that this is true. But some people at that period, because they were suspicious about teachings of the church, especially because of the misbehavior of some of the authorities in the church, I'm not saying all, but some of the people in the church who were misbehaving and misusing their position as religious leaders, they started to make serious doubts about the compatibility of religious ideas of the church and rational arguments. And they were in favor of reason. So when they thought that something is against reason, they started to reject it. This is also something important in that period. The other element, the other factor, was the disagreements, the controversies that started inside the church and also between the church and the European leaders. First of all, I refer to the controversies inside the church. You know that there were some Christian thinkers who were not happy with the ideas of the Roman Catholic Church. For example, in Germany, Martin Luther was against some of the ideas of the church. And he started a reform in the church. And gradually the Protestantism was formed. But this could not be that much influential if it was not backed up by some German and then other European rulers or princes. So because there was a controversy between the church, between the Pope and some European kings or princes, they had unfortunately contributed to the religious and theological atmosphere of the Europe. I'm saying unfortunately because we feel that theological issues must be studied, and theological positions must be evaluated by themselves. It's not good that when a king or a president or, for example, a prince is happy with some idea to use his power to back up that idea and make a split inside the faith. If that idea is correct, of course it must be welcomed and it must be helped and assisted. But just because you are unhappy with some people, or because you have money and power, you should not let yourself to interfere in some issues that you are not aware of and you are not expert in that regard. Anyway, the political problems caused some people backing up some party and other people who were against them back up other parties. And especially this happened after many bloodshedding wars, and also it was followed up by many bloody wars, and many people were killed in Europe because of the religious disagreements and religious conflicts. The other factor was a great interest which was shown in that time in humanism. So people, unfortunately, after being very much concerned with human ideas, with human desires, with human wants and needs, they totally went farther from faith. And as some people say, some thinkers say, in the modern age, God was replaced by man. The other thing was the collapse of Byzantine Empire in the 15th century. This was also a great factor in changing the spiritual, intellectual atmosphere of the Europe. And if we want to have a very overall and general idea, we could say that after many centuries, about 1,000 years of dominance and control of Europe by the church, these factors led to appearance of a new age, appearance of what is known as Renaissance, which literally means new birth, as if the Europe was given a new life. You cannot say exactly in which year this started, or even in which decade or century, because it was a gradual process. Some people say that this happened in the 14th, 15th, and 16th century. But definitely in the 16th century, the new ideas and the modern age were there and were very much visible. So one of the things which is important for us to know in our study of philosophy is that after people entered modern age, after people, I'm not saying all people, but many people, especially some thinkers, some educated people, felt unhappy with the teachings of the church, and they saw that some of the teachings of the church is against reason or against science, they started to develop a global doubt about everything. For example, a French thinker who is known as Montaigne, he was very skeptical, not only about certain discipline or about, for example, teachings of a certain group of people. he had what we call it global skepticism, because he felt that if everything which people had very much attachment to it in medieval ages has changed, if scientific ideas have changed, if religious ideas have changed, if tendencies even in arts are changed, if fashions are changing, so how can we prove, how can we make sure that there is something as true, something as real, which we must discover? You see, again, the same idea that Sufis had is repeating. So Montaigne had the idea that we must be very sensitive regarding our arguments, regarding our proofs, and we should not accept easily everything. So he was saying that even the new scientific findings may be not correct, maybe they are wrong, and later we can understand that they are wrong. This skepticism was not limited to Montaigne. He was a great figure, a great personality in this regard, one of the people who marks the turning point here. But it was followed up by other people, by other thinkers. And this spirit of skepticism was very much common in Europe at that time. Because when many things that you are used to for many centuries are taken away from you, then you would start thinking that perhaps other things are also in the same position. They are also wrong, but just you need some time to realize that they are wrong. And skepticism not only is psychologically very difficult, not only it bothers and annoys the person, because the person loses any sense of confidence and peace in his mind, but also theologically and morally, it's very dangerous. Theologically, it's very dangerous, because if you are skeptical, so you cannot have faith, you cannot have belief. Because as soon as you want to commit yourself to God, to what God requires from you, to worship God, and even be prepared to have sacrifice, a doubt comes to your mind. And this doubt stops you. It's also morally very dangerous. Because if people feel that there is no firm ground for moral values, if they have doubt about moral values, so why should they bother themselves to be strict? Why should they bother themselves to observe moral values, even if it is against their short-term interests? If I tell lie, I may lose in the long term. But many people do not understand this. They see that by telling a lie, they can have lots of profits, lots of benefits in the short term. So why should they leave all these short-term benefits for something which they have doubt about it? You cannot say that you will be rewarded hereafter, or for example, telling truth is good for humanity, and even in this world it's good for you, because people have doubt about this. If they have doubt about this, if they are skeptical, so how can we expect them to commit themselves to morality? So this skepticism, which was the perhaps second term of skepticism after the one which used to be there in the Greeks, is something which every student of philosophy must take it serious and must consider it. After this, in the 17th century, a big French philosopher known as René Descartes, started to found a new rationalism and to defend philosophy and to argue that it's possible to have certainty in philosophy. Insha'Allah ta'ala, in the next session we will see what René Descartes and other rationalists did to revive the interest of the Europe in philosophy. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.